I'm Kara Lawrence. Tonight at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall at Western Michigan University, the Bullock Performance Institute will present Dimitri Matheny and a jazz ensemble, including Gene Kniffick, Tom Kniffick, and Sean Dobbins. And Dimitri Matheny is here in the studio at WMUK. So nice to meet you.
Good morning.
As well as Tom Kniffick. Hello.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dimitri Matheny, if folks don't already know, is the leader of the Dimitri Matheny Group and has played a role in the making of over 120 albums. And his newest album, Jazz Noir, is available for pre-order at DimitriMatheny.com. So we're going to have lots to talk about this hour. And I guess one thing I didn't mention is your instrument. It's the flugelhorn.
I'm so glad that you're talking about the flugelhorn.
Doesn't happen very often.
No, and a lot of people don't know it. You know, you say you play the flugelhorn, and they think you're talking about some Dr. Seuss instrument or something. You know?
Well, this is the instrument that is you. Mm-hmm. You could call it, it's your identity. Mm-hmm. So would you take us back to when you picked it up?
Absolutely. And actually, that's a beautiful segue, because when I first was at Interlochen Arts Academy 30 years ago as a kid that was obsessed with jazz, I met Tom Kniffick, and he told me what to listen to. And I would go to the listening library and listen to all of these classic jazz recordings. And that's when I first heard the flugelhorn being played by people like Thad Jones and Miles Davis and Chet Baker. And at the time, I played trumpet, and I doubled on flugelhorn like a lot of trumpet players do. And then years later, I switched to the flugelhorn exclusively.
Tom, can you elaborate on this meeting back at the Interlochen Arts Academy?
Well, one of the wonderful things of having some longevity to your career is that, like, you have different highs and different cycles and different experiences that could really only take place over longer stretches of time. So my first teaching position was at the Interlochen Arts Academy. This was a while ago, and one of my very first students, literally, as we were codifying the jazz program, we were just, you know, inking the deal to make it like an official program there, was Dimitri, who I think it was nothing short of a pilgrimage from Arizona to the northern woods of Michigan in search of, you know, camaraderie in the art form and input and environment. And you know, like so many of the kids there, who's just so hungry for it, you know.
You must have looked at your roster and thought, Dimitri Matheny. This is strange.
Pat's younger brother. No, it's a different spelling and all that.
Well, but I know, I was thinking of the fact that it's like maybe you have a Russian mother and an Irish father.
You know, funny.
You know, Kara, my stage name is Pat Shostakovich.
Pat O. Shostakovich.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Very interesting. Is there a story there?
No.
Okay.
But, you know, really, as I think about it, I mean, he was probably the first real, you know, you're developing a program and you're just starting to, you know, there's always interest in it. But he was the first truly self-motivated there just for that student. And so the wonderful thing is, you know, years go by and you keep track of each other. And we've done pretty well of just being aware of each other and seeing each other at conferences. But so we're talking, I can't remember the year, was it 84 or 5? Mm-hmm. You know, we played, you know, on stage at Interlochen, I think, for John Redmer's memorial. And then we're always talking, yeah, we got to finally, you know, on a Midwest tour, we got together a year and a half ago, and it was exquisite. I had just such a great time, and we promised to do more, and this is the beginning of that.
I listened to an interview you gave a while back, a couple years ago, Dimitri, and in the interview you said, I think mentoring is really important. Mm. And here you are in a university setting. Mm. I think you must be following that impulse to be a mentor and be among young kids.
Sure, and it flows both ways, certainly. I mean, Tom is like a wiser older brother, you know, to me. You know, it was one of his very first teaching gigs, he says, and it was for me at Interlochen, was the first time when I was just beginning to take music seriously. And to have an authority figure, a musician that played as well as he did and you know, classically trained but really well versed in jazz, to be not only encouraging of my obsession but also be equally obsessed with this music, you know, it was a great inspiration to me. So I really feel like there's definitely a tradition, especially in jazz, of kind of paying it forward and encouraging less experienced musicians and younger musicians, and I try to do that. And you know, my two great mentors in this music have been Tom Kanific and Art Farmer.
How does the mentor role go beyond that of, say, a university teacher?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question. Well, in the case of Art Farmer, you know, with him, I probably learned as much about life as about music. In fact, when I first started studying with him, it was only about music. And after a while, I finally got up the courage to ask him, you know, life questions. And, you know, I still think about the things he told me. And an example is, you know, he did a lot of touring and working with regional rhythm sections wherever he went. And bands always sounded great. They always sounded beautifully rehearsed, even though I knew they hadn't really rehearsed. They came together at sound check and, you know, and I said, Art, how is it that your bands always sound so good? And he said, Dimitri, if you find that you're the smartest cat in the room, you're in the wrong room.
So in other words, make sure you've got some good people around.
Yeah, you know, surround yourself with talents greater than your own and you can't lose.
Wow. Well, he was a great talent, though. That must have been difficult after a while. I read that Art Farmer spent his later years in Germany or Vienna, Austria. Mm-hmm. Is that where you went to study?
No, he in 1959, 1960, right after the success of his jazz tet with Benny Golson, I think they won the Downbeat poll that year. He moved to Vienna. He got a job as the soloist with the Vienna Radio Orchestra. And, you know, it was quite an amazing thing. It was a time when a lot of black jazz musicians were moving to Europe because of this sort of, you know, they were frustrated with the situation here and civil rights and so forth. And they'd go over to Europe and be received like the way that a lot of symphonic and chamber music musicians are treated. And so it was a kind of a revelation. But he actually went there, started a family, had a job, and stayed there for the rest of his life. But he kept an apartment in New York, and about 6 months out of the year would tour from his base in New York. So yeah, kind of an amazing business model.
I also read that he considered himself a little introverted.
For sure. But Tom has worked with him, and he can speak to that. Was he as soft-spoken and introverted?
Sort of, for me, he was like a certain a gentleman of a certain era. You know, carried himself with a lot of dignity. But you know, it came out when it needed to, and he was a wonderful, concise, and supportive musical director. I mean, he just made sure if most everything was together when it needed to be from the get-go. But he had great ways of getting the best out of you and suggestions and things with minimal effort. But in two ways, you know, on stage, obviously, he just his heart poured out. You know, his heart and soul is just like every moment on stage was an epiphany. You know, but he was very competent in taking care of business and making sure everything was the way it needed to be. So it was just sort of like to me, it was just like a elegant gentleman. You know, a gentleman artist.
My guests are bassist Tom Kanific and flugelhorn soloist Dimitri Matheny, and they're performing with Gene Kanific and Sean Dobbins tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Music starts at 7:30, and there's a pre-concert get-together with musicians at 7 p.m., hosted by Dr. Bob White. You can find out more at wmich.edu/music. Why don't we take a break here and listen to something from Art Farmer while we're on the topic. Would you mind introducing this cut from this album?
Sure. Well, we did a workshop yesterday kind of about Art Farmer's unique approach to jazz improvisation, the kind of lyrical melodic approach. And one of the students asked about recordings, and I was listing some of my favorite recordings, and Tom said, well, what about Blame It on My Youth? You know, Tom, do you want to introduce the title track?
Absolutely. Oscar Levant, you know, the famous, how do you describe him? You know, he had a talent for genius, somebody said. And he was,
enfant terrible.
Yeah, and, you know, George Gershwin's, you know, best friend / nemesis or whatever, you know, thorn in his side in a fun way, wrote this piece, Blame It on My Youth, and it's just, you know, one of the great haunting melodies of all time, and it still keeps coming back. I think Brad Meldow did a sensational cover, you know, on one of his Art of the Trio CDs. It's just one of those pieces that, I mean, it's classic. It just goes right through you. So, and the sound, I think, is spectacular. I think everything you need to know about Art Farmer is in like the first 5 seconds.
That's Art Farmer from his album, The Art Farmer Quintet, Blame It on My Youth, an Oscar Levant tune. It was suggested here by my guest, Dimitri Matheny, who is another world-class flugelhornist and is performing tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall with my other guest, bassist Tom Kinnifick, as well as Gene Kinnifick on piano and Sean Dobbins on drums and percussion. So, Tom, bringing together these folks, I do see two Kinnifics in the mix.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I think it's pretty great to have this mix of generations here.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Well, there's a lot of angles to it. Sean Dobbins was the drummer for the last tour that Dimitri put together, and you know, his drummer of choice in Michigan, and I've loved getting to know him and play with him over the years, but it seems to be increasing in frequency, which is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful drummer. And then it just seemed like the right time. In fact, maybe, did you suggest Gene?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I would have in a heartbeat, but it came from Dimitri first. And it's sort of a generations thing now at this point, because, you know, we've known each other for so long, and it's you know, moving it forward. And we're also playing in Chicago at the Jazz Showcase, the club of Chicago, a week from today, and that's Gene's hometown now, so it all just made a lot of sense, you know.
Wow, that's really, really great. I should say that the set list tonight, there looks like it, among the things that may be selected, includes one from Gene. It's called If I Could Find You, and I think Gene's recorded this already.
Yeah, that's on his first release, the trio release. But again, that was Dimitri's call.
I love that piece. Yeah, he's a beautiful writer. And, you know, he's been having a lot of success as a composer and commissions and whatnot. And I'd like to, you know, go on record and say I discovered Gene Kinnifick and you know, really take credit for that.
Well, I think there are two people here who could claim that.
I'm just trying to keep up. You know, that's my role.
Well, some of the other highlights would include the famous tune Stormy Weather, Harold Arlen and Ted Kohler. But I also see Soka Nova, and that's one of your tunes.
Where are you seeing all this?
Well, I'm looking at a printout, the Bullock Performance Institute program for tonight.
Okay.
So, of course, it's a jazz concert, yeah. So I know none of this could be set in stone.
No, but we'll play those songs for sure.
We'll do anything you say. We always do.
So those are some of the highlights, and I should tell people again that the concert starts at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall, and there are tickets available at the door. There's a pre-concert talk, and I misspoke earlier. That is actually going to be managed by Tom himself tonight.
The baton was passed just a few days ago, and I'm happy to do it. You know, it's been incredible catching up. Dimitri arrived yesterday. Did a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful class. It was very, you know, how do I say this? It was an angle from beyond academia, and you know, he performs up to 200 nights a year, and so there's certain things that you learn doing that. You know, being in that world all the time. That's just, you know, it's sincere and it's important and it's people based and experiential based and. It was really great for the students. Then they responded in kind. They were just like all aglow. And so, you know, we've already been catching up major league. We were up quite late last night just going over so many things, and we've got a lot more time to catch up too.
Was this a lecture style get together, or did you include actual playing?
Oh, we played a bit. Art Farmer had an interesting approach to improvisation that was really based in verbal communication, and he would describe, like you just played a beautiful recording. He had a partner, Clifford Jordan, saxophone player that he worked with quite a bit during that period. And when he would describe a show from the night before, he would say, "Man, did you check it out last night? Clifford said bazoozape, so I said bazeedap, and then he said bazeebzeebzeeb, so I said bazeebzeebap, right?" And that's how he would describe a musical encounter. He said and I said, because to him it's just like verbal communication. And so we talked a little bit about that with the students, and we talked about note choice. Art was very big on choosing certain notes and having kind of a real melodic, lyrical approach to improvisation, as opposed to patterns and scales and arpeggios and that sort of thing.
I could see that. There is the more you play an instrument, the more it seems that each note becomes so distinct in itself.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own personality, just a pitch.
Mm-hmm. And he was very big on listening to singers, listen to singers and listen to how they phrase and try to phrase like a vocalist, which is, I think, it's something that it's almost a classical sensibility, to play sweetly and to play and to shape a melody and that sort of thing.
Well, now's a good time to hear something from one of your recent albums. So you want to tell me something about Sagebrush Rebellion?
Sure. Sagebrush Rebellion is the story of a little boy from the lonesome desert, who moved out into the world and tried to play bebop. No, it's a live date that we did in a club in San Diego. It's got a wonderful pianist, Nick Manson, Justin Grinnell on the bass, Duncan Moore on the drums. So it's a nice West Coast rhythm section. And I really wasn't aware that we were being recorded. We were just kind of calling to, so there's not a lot of arrangements. They're just tunes. We're just playing tunes. And then at the end of the night, the guy came up to me and said, "Here's your tape." And I said, "Oh, we liked it." So we released it as a CD.
Even better in some ways. You know, you're not self-conscious.
Right.
I believe that's how that Errol Garner album, Concert by the Sea, was recorded.
Oh, that's a classic.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to this top track from Sagebrush Rebellion, It Could Happen to You.
Okay.
Well, as you can hear, that is a live recording of my guest, Dimitri Matheny. So you're in the studio with Tom Knifik. Dimitri, you're performing tonight at 7:30, and if that's any hint, this is going to be a terrific swinging concert. Mm-hmm. Let's mention again that this comes from the album Sagebrush Rebellion. Is it one of your more recent albums?
It came out in 2014.
So, wow. Yeah. Okay. People can follow up, I know, at Dimitri Matheny. com. Matheny is M-A-T-H-E-N-Y, and Dimitri at D-M-I-T-R-I. There's another album coming up soon that you're still working on, but it's a very exciting project, I think. If you're like me and love going to films and have developed a taste for film noir, there's some terrific, moody sort of music.
Now, we're having so much fun with this, movie themes and crime jazz and all that spy. And not just the classic films with, Bogart and that sort of thing, but also what I grew up with, the television detective crime dramas of the 1970s, Macmillan and Wife and Columbo and all that kind of thing, Streets of San Francisco. So we're having a ball.
Speaking of San Francisco, you moved there in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your home base still?
No, I now live in Washington State. As of 2 weeks ago, I live in a little town in Washington State, about halfway between Portland and Seattle. But I lived in San Francisco for 20 years, and kind of you know, made my bones there, started my career there, and it feels like home to me. I love going back there.
Is there a story here about gentrification and startups and Silicon Valley pushing people out?
You know, there's a movie coming out. You may have heard about it, that Nancy Pelosi's daughter is a filmmaker, and she made this movie that's just now coming out, a documentary called San Francisco 2.0. And it's all about how the counterculture in the arts community is kind of being pushed out by the new wealth of this new wave of tech. You know, what has happened is Mayor Gavin Newsom made these sweetheart deals with all these tech companies. So people are now, you know, living in the city that once were maybe down in Palo Alto, or, you know, and fewer and fewer artists and musicians and poets and school teachers and firemen and police and people like that can afford to live in the city anymore. So even if they work in San Francisco, they tend to work in the exurbs or live out there. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a shame, you know, especially because when you think of San Francisco, you think of, you know, flowers in your hair and the summer of love and hippies and, you know.
It has a legend to it, and a very much association with the counterculture.
Yeah.
It's the creativity great musical movements coming.
Sure. But these things happen in cycles. You know, they'll be back.
True. Just a few more bubbles away, I suppose.
That's right.
you also mentioned in the interview I listened to the other day that jazz has become a global music.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And a way to communicate around the world. You can go anywhere and play jazz.
Oh, for sure. Actually, Tom was the first person that made me aware of this, that, you know, this music invented by some brilliant African-American musicians 100 years ago is now played and enjoyed by people all over the world. And, you know, Tom, you've traveled a lot. You've been to Africa many times. And
everywhere you go, there's people that are either touched by it or have studied it in their own way and have integrated it into their own music and created their own. We were even talking about Norwegian jazz, which is, you know, there are great artists there that have taken it and a little Nordic bent to it. And it's, I mean, it's everywhere. It's a beautiful thing. And we were talking about, you know, certain purists saying, well, that's not really jazz. Is that, but you call it a process, jazz being a process. And for me, the fact that it's able to change and adapt and be such an important part to so many artists' lives around the world speaks to the profound nature of it and the profound nature of that process that it would, you know, it would affect the human condition so greatly and so widely, you know.
Well said.
And it would be completely unfair to ask for jazz to stay in one style and one
absolutely
box.
Sure. I think it's something we can be really proud of, you know, as Americans. You know, it's one of the, I mean, there are a lot of things that we export to the rest of the world that maybe we shouldn't be so proud of. But, I mean, comic books and quilting and modern dance and jazz, and now I'm starting to run out. You know, there aren't that many things that are you know, really uniquely American art forms and that are now played and enjoyed by people all over the world.
I did talk to Aaron Deal last week, and I said, it seems to me that the puzzle, or not the problem, but the interesting challenge for the young jazz pianist these days is to take a look at where jazz came from and see all the possibilities you could go into now.
Mm-hmm.
You can study a lot of different types of jazz, but how do you become original?
Right.
And to him, he said, rather than set all that aside and just try to become original on his own by practicing away from everyone, that he's gone as far into these other styles and tried to learn the dialects, tried to learn the languages.
Yeah,
yeah. But the history has that now. I mean, it's so funny. I mean, my career has been in music, but I can think of the beginning of my career was almost a third of the history of jazz ago, or maybe even more in years. It's wild. I mean, the entire history, 100 years, so you know, 40 years ago, we had just a fraction of the music that we have now and have dealt with it. And there's, you know, the sense, you know, when I remember when I was a kid and getting going, the sense of just going back and really mining that was like ludicrous, because jazz was always a creative and art form. You're supposed to innovate and also invite different influences and see where that goes. And the idea that you just go back and be, you know, a librarian about it, or a museum piece about it, I never even heard talk like that. I don't know if we really
right.
Unless they were somebody from that era that was just playing the music they grew up playing.
Right.
But it was still living from that time in individuals.
Yeah.
You know,
UB
Blake. I mean,
right, absolutely.
Yeah. But now we have, you know, an entire like a vertical history that you can go back or in the live in the middle or try to press forward with it.
That, you know, that reminds me of another great Art Farmer quote. You know, he was very... very concerned about pleasing his audience and, you know, really reaching his audience. But he also knew that he had a responsibility. I said, well, you know, some people in the audience, they only want to hear what they've heard before. They want to hear, you know, their favorite selections from your recordings or their favorite songs from the Great American Songbook, you know. And there are other people in the audience that want to hear your newest, what's new, you know. And he said, well, that's the thing about jazz. It's like that god Janus, you know, it's got one face looking this way and one looking the other way. You know, you have to have one foot in the past and one, you know, firmly in going toward the future. You know, so I think that that's very much part of the jazz ethos, to honor the tradition, but to always be looking forward.
Could we talk about the word standard?
Mm-hmm.
What is a standard in jazz? And how do you create a new standard?
For me, there are more than one types of standards. That's a tricky thing. And we were just talking about this with some students. Had to be in the last 2 days. So there's something called the American Songbook, and we have standards of that. And that's music of the 20s, 30s, 40s,
did somebody
50s.
Publish the Great American Songbook?
Well, there's, you know, that it exists. I mean, there are editions called that, but, you know, it's basically the music of, you know, the great film and stage composers that eventually jazz people adopted, but not necessarily they exist on their own. The Gershwin Songbook, you know, mm-hmm. Sammy Kahn, mm-hmm. Jules Verne, you know, it goes on and on. So in our world, we call that the American Songbook and standards. But there's also a lot of great music written by jazz musicians that have become jazz standards, you know, and some of those reflect some of those other American songbook works in form and harmony, but they're their own sets of music. And it gets confused, and certainly I'm not the authority on this, but that's how I see it.
Yeah, I think that's very beautifully said.
And they kind of, and they blend in certain ways, and you usually have some balance of, like tonight's concert will be some combination of American songbook standards and some brand new music, and you hope that they become standards.
Absolutely. And I think when a lot of the times when people say the Great American Songbook or American Popular Song, they're talking about Broadway and Hollywood songs from the 1920s through the 60s. But if you think about it, there are certain composers, people like Stevie Wonder or Burt Bacharach, you know, that a lot of the music that they wrote in the 1970s and later is now played mm-hmm. in, you know, by musicians of all genres and known by people and requested by people. And, you know, there's songs that sort of become part of the popular consciousness.
A young hotshot jazz pianist came through the Gilmore not long ago and played his take on a rap artist's music, Lamar, I think is his name, not too sure. But I guess if you're going to be taking pop songs and creating jazz versions of them, why not take what you grew up with listening to? Is that another ripe field for standards?
I think what Dimitri was just referring to is that the American Songbook is evolving, you know, maybe... we think of it from like a 1970-80 perspective, it was everything 20 years mm-hmm. before that time back
mm-hmm.
and now in the 2015 mm-hmm. so maybe it's 20 years back from now, which includes that. And so the thing, it's an evolutionary process, and it's certainly not finite, and it's, you know, in 20 years I'm sure there's going to be some wonderful stuff we consider standards or part of the American
sure.
Songbook that we
well, you mentioned Brad Meldow a moment ago, and that's someone who, you know, he has taken a lot of songs by Radiohead, for example, and, you know, contemporary bands, you know, that are really popular, and given them kind of the jazz treatment with improvisation, and is you know, personally responsible for kind of expanding the repertoire for a lot of jazz musicians that are working today.
Mm. My guests are Dimitri Matheny and Tom Knifik, and they're two of the musicians featured tonight in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Music starts at 7:30. It's a Bullock Performance Institute program. Also on the program are pianist Gene Knifik and drummer Sean Dobbins. Dimitri Matheny is a recording artist with over 120 albums to his credit, and as a leader, I think about over...
Now, this is number 10. And number 11 is coming out at Christmas.
Okay. Yeah. You can find more at dimitrimatheny.com. Let's hear a little bit more off of the most recent record.
Okay.
I'm going to ask you to pick out a tune for me.
How about Petite Belle? It's a, you know, Tom was just mentioning how there are certain songs that are written by jazz musicians and jazz composers that... This is a recent discovery. It was actually from Art Farmer's repertoire. It's by bassist Steve Swallow, and it's a bossa nova, but with a rather interesting form, Petite Belle.
Tickets are available at the door tonight at 7:30. I'm really glad we switched formats here this morning on WMUK. We just heard music played by my guest, Dimitri Matheny, from his album Sagebrush Rebellion, Petite Belle, the name of that tune. Wow, wonderful playing. I'm just in such a calm mood, finally, after rushing to work and all the coffee I've ingested. This is a beautiful feeling, and I'm sure folks will have a beautiful feeling in person tonight at 7:30. There's such friendship between you two. I can't help but think there's going to be a lot of camaraderie on stage.
Mm, yeah, well, I'm just thrilled to work with these musicians. I mean, what a treat. This is a fantastic rhythm section, you know. Both Knifiks are an embarrassment of riches, what talent. And then Sean Dobbins, man, he's got that Detroit thing. I just love his sound and his feel. What a treat.
He's firing on 8 cylinders all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I want to remind folks again, the music starts at 7:30. There's a 7 o'clock live and interactive session with the musicians in conversation on stage. So you can get there a little early for that. Tickets are available at the door. And you can find out more at wmish.edu/music/events. Well, thank you both so much for spending the whole morning here.
Thank you,
Dimitri.
Thank you so much, Kara.
I'm going to leave you with a little treat and remind folks that Jazz Noir is Dimitri's upcoming album. You can pre-order it at his website, dimitrimatheny.com. And we've been listening now to music from Vertigo. Bernard Herrmann scored this. He's a hero of yours.
I love it.
Well, this album will be released when?
In December.
In December. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. We'll keep track of that. Thanks, Dimitri.
Thank you.